Hello, everyone. Welcome to Zero's TV and The Chopping Block. I'm Max Wheathy. I'm joined today by Keir Kalan, the CIO of Scorpion Capital. Thank you so much for being with me today, Keir.
Thanks for having me, Max. Great to be here.
All right. So before we get into the details, why don't you just tell us who's on The Chopping Block today?
It's a company called QuantumScape. The ticker is QS. It has about an 18 to 20 billion market cap, depending on the day that you catch it. They claim they have a breakthrough discovery in solid-state cells, batteries, for the electric vehicle market.
So before we get into the specifics of QS, why don't we talk about the battery market and the technology in general? What is the current state of the battery market between solid-state and lithium-ion batteries?
So the vast majority of batteries, in fact, I think all of them for electric vehicles today, are based on conventional lithium-ion technology. It's the kind of battery that you typically see in your cell phone. It's the kind of battery which powers your laptop. And the way a lithium-ion battery works, the way the most batteries work, is that you have a negative electrode on one side called an anode, and you have a positive electrode on the other side called a cathode. And in between that, you have something called an electrolyte. So those are the three components. So sort of picture a swimming pool, right? So on one side, you have the anode, then you kind of have this pool of water, which in a lithium-ion battery is typically a lithium-based liquid, some sort of a gel. So the anode on one side, the liquid in the middle, and on the other side, you have the cathode. And as the lithium ions move from the negative electrode to the positive electrode, they discharge the battery, right? And that powers your phone, it powers your car, consumer electronics. And then when the lithium ions move the other way, the battery is charged. So that's typically the way that a battery works. Now, a solid-state battery is a radically different concept. It turns out that by having that liquid separator, it makes the battery heavier. And there are other issues. For example, you know, it can be flammable, right? Like a laptop battery, you know, blowing up mid-flight. And so the holy grail for, I think, 100, maybe even 150 years has been replacing that liquid electrolyte in a battery with a solid. Because then you can get better density, you get better safety. There are all sorts of other advantages from swapping out that separator. The fundamental problem is if you imagine swimming through a pool, it's easy to do it if it's a liquid, if it's water. Now imagine if you replace that liquid with a solid material, okay? Like a lithium metal-based ceramic. It's not so easy to swim to the other side of the pool in reverse direction, right? So that is why this has pretty much been a pipe dream for 150 years. QuantumScape claims that they found a magic material for that separator that enables lithium ions to move back and forth and perform better than a lithium ion battery. So that's just sort of the setup for how batteries work, what a solid state battery is, and what the key technology is that QuantumScape claims to have.
Okay, so you said it is the holy grail, really, of battery technology, and that has created just this influx of capital into the battery space as people chase after this holy grail. And that's definitely part of the story with this company. So how much money has been thrown at this problem, and who are some of the big names that are really driving the hype around this company?
There's been a lot of academic research into solid-state batteries for, you know, I think, decades. And people, you know, they haven't gotten very far because, you know, as you kind of think back to the analogy that I laid out with a swimming pool, you just kind of use common sense, you understand why this is a very difficult problem. And when we actually spoke to former employees of QuantumScape, you know, one of the employees classified it as essentially an unsolvable problem. He said, people have no idea how difficult this is. It's basically Nobel Prize winning work that needs to be done. There's a fair amount of funding, academic funding, government funding, and QuantumScape, I think, has probably, you know, thrown more capital at the problem than anybody else. But I think the striking thing is, after working on this problem for a decade, what they've shown is not very impressive. So they've basically shown what are called single-layer pouch cells. These are tiny little cells. One of those prototypes that they talk about is 70 by 85 millimeters. Okay, it's about the size of a credit card. They have other samples in the test that they show that are 30 by 30 millimeters, sort of about the size of a coin. So the square surface area on those is very, very tiny. And if you actually look at the total amount of square surface area and all the layers that would go into a full battery pack, you know, it's measured in football field sized surface area. right? So it's one thing to show something that's the size of like a quarter, right? Under perfect artificial laboratory test conditions where you're tweaking the temperature, you know, you're tweaking the pressure, you're tweaking the charging rate. There are all kinds of tricks and gimmicks that one can play to claim a certain kind of a battery performance. Despite all the money they throw at the problem, a couple things that are notable. One is that the cells are really tiny. The second issue is that they're only single layer cells. For an actual battery pack, they have to take these single layers and they have to stack them up to 100 layers. I mean, their own filings say that the number of layers in one of these cells has to be north of 100. So there's sort of a two-dimensional problem and a three-dimensional problem. You have to show that you can go to a much bigger two-dimensional area. Then you have to show that your technology actually scales in three dimensions with multiple layers. Despite all the money that's been thrown at this, it's actually quite shocking that all they've really shown to date are these tiny little cells, mostly single layer. And recently they proclaimed that they had a breakthrough with some multi-layer cells, but they're only like 4 or 5 layers. It's like 4 to 5% of the way there for the number of layers that they have to stack for the cell to be inviable. So it's kind of a funny thing. You know, when you ask about the amount of money that's been thrown at the problem, you think that they would have come up with more, but that's all they have.
So, I mean, but that's really kind of the honest claims about the technology. That's what they have out there. That's what's available. But what about some of the things that you think are maybe a little bit more dishonest about what they're able to do?
So there are 5 or 6 key technical claims that they make. And they actually frame this pretty well in their own presentations. They say, okay, you know, here are the 5 or 6 key criteria that a battery has to hit to be viable in the electric vehicle market. You know, these are the 5 or 6 things that any large automotive manufacturer has to have in a battery, okay? And if you fail on any one of those dimensions, you're simply not viable. You're just not competitive versus lithium ion, right? Lithium ion works, it scales, right? Tesla cars, they work just fine with lithium ion batteries. So unless a solid state battery hits those parameters, it's not gonna be competitive. Those key criteria are things like fast charge, right? The battery has to be able to be charged in a pretty rapid period of time, right? You're going shopping at the mall, you're out of juice, you wanna come back, you know, 30, 40 minutes later, and you wanna be able to drive the car. So number one, fast charging. Number two, you need long cycle life, right? The battery's gotta last. You know, batteries degrade the more times they're charged and discharged. Every battery has a finite lifespan. So you have to make sure that one of these batteries can last to power a car, like, you know, 200, 300,000 miles over the course of its useful life. The third thing is you have to show performance in low temperature conditions. As we'll talk about in a second, that's been one of the key things that has impeded solid state development efforts is that they just don't really work in cold conditions. The only way you can get ions to move through a solid separator is by heating it, right? If you take a ceramic or a metal-based separator and you heat it, you know, all of a sudden it becomes more porous, right? So low temperature operation has been a key stumbling block, but that's one of the criteria that they have to hit, right? If you live in Chicago, if you live in New York, the Midwest, large parts of Europe, you know, performance in low temperature conditions is absolutely vital. The next criteria is battery life in low temperature conditions, right? It's got to work in the cold. It's also got to last in the cold. You know, before we even get into what they claim along each of those dimensions and what we noticed based on our analysis or interviews with solid state experts, some of the leading researchers in the field, a number of former employees of the company, there are a lot of things that we discovered that lead us to believe that those key claims are misleading. They are grossly exaggerated, or in some cases, we think that they're just outright fraudulent. But before diving into that detail, I think one of the most important things for people to understand about what they've shown is that it's a very low capacity battery. The capacity of the battery is in fact so low that they take great pains to never come right out and say what it is. So we had a leading battery researcher use some of the scraps of data that they have in their fine print to estimate what the capacity of the battery is. And it's pitiful. You know, it's about 1/4 the size of a typical hearing aid battery, right? So not only are they showing batteries that are the size of a coin or the size of a credit card, you can't do anything with them. And the thing with battery research, right, there's a lot of fraud in the battery world. You know, fraud is a well-known problem in the battery world, going back to Thomas Edison. Right, there's a quote from Thomas Edison that we have in our presentation. You know, battery stocks, highly promoted battery companies were a thing in the 1800s, and it led him to actually talk about the problem. And one of the common ways that companies cheat is by using cells that have really low capacities and really low loadings, because it's one thing to show performance on those different criteria on a tiny cell under highly artificial conditions. It's an entirely different thing when you're actually trying to power a vehicle. Just to kind of frame at a global level, you know, what the fundamental problem here is, it's a tiny little cell, and they make a bunch of claims, and the claims just don't stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah, and in your report, you mentioned that this problem of misstatement or overstatement of the ability of these batteries is such a problem that even the industry has created a standard of the data that needs to be present to make a claim really worthwhile for the academic community to even consider it. And these guys, in none of their presentations, in none of their reports, meet those criteria in any single one.
It's interesting you picked up on that. It is, I mean, it's such a well-known problem that people talk about it, right? It's actually quite surprising that it's so widespread that a leading battery journal has actually published a checklist. And if you look at the checklist, it's sort of like this affidavit, right? You got to check off a bunch of boxes. You got to initial them. Like, they're so worried about people, you know, bullshitting with fake data that they're making you essentially sign under every little scrap of data. And when you kind of go through that checklist, it's remarkable. QuantumScape shows basically none of the stuff that's on the list, right? They would not meet the criteria just to be accepted for publication in a battery journal, right? But here they are with, you know, sort of a $20 billion market cap. But it's a common problem. And, you know, the other point I'll make there is that there are a lot of high profile battery frauds and failures, and we detail a bunch of those in the report. A number of those were actually backed by, you know, the lead investors in QuantumScape, solid state battery companies, a target of the EV market, very similar sorts of technologies. And they engaged in the kinds of tricks and gimmicks that those guidelines that these battery journals, these researchers are putting out, they played all those tricks and investors fell for it. And those companies were later shown to be frauds and just outright failures. And in our opinion, QuantumScape's red flags are identical to the red flags those companies exhibited before they blew up. And we think it's only a matter of time before QuantumScape is going to be in the same list as these companies as, you know, Nikola, you know, Sakti 3, A123. I mean, you just kind of go down the list of these companies that overhype battery claims that were pretty quickly shown to be, you know, nonsense.
Okay. Well, I want to get into these specific claims that you highlighted, the five claims, but I think it's really helpful first to actually say, we said that solid-state batteries are the holy grail, but what is it? Is it the fact that they are faster charging, that they have a longer, you know, theoretical life cycle, where they can handle more charges? Why do we want to switch from lithium-ion, which supposedly works, they work at scale, to solid-state? Why is it the holy grail? Because I think it will help us pinpoint, you know, the important claims out of this that need to be true for solid-state to work.
Yeah, you know, it's actually an interesting question, because those criteria are not criteria where solid state actually has any inherent advantage. It actually has a disadvantage on all of those, right? Those are just like the table stakes. You just kind of want to play in the game. You got to show that you have cycle life, that you can be fast charged and so forth, right? So, you know, your question is actually very interesting. Yeah, it's the holy grail, but, you know, you look at these gigafactories, you look at the global install base of lithium ion battery manufacturing technology. It raises a really good question, like, you know, why do we even need solid state? Yeah, there are these theoretical advantages, okay, you know, from higher energy density and so forth. But I think the mistake that people make when they focus on the shiny new thing like QuantumScape is that, you know, there's something called an experience curve in a lot of technologies, right? And as more of a particular item is produced, it gets cheaper. Right. And if you look at lithium ion costs, there was something like, you know, $200 a kilowatt 10 years ago. They're now, I believe, around 100. People think they're going to be about $80 a kilowatt soon. They're going to keep tanking from there. Yeah, there are issues with it, but, you know, the technology is not standing still. Right. So by the time that a solid state technology would come out, you might look at it and be like, well, why would I even want to switch? You know, lithium ion tends to work just fine. So, you know, there are theoretical advantages to solid state technology, but, you know, they're not even dramatic enough where I think it's worth talking about, because where solid state is today, it's not about getting to those advantages. It's showing that they can even be viable against lithium ion batteries. Like, that's where we are, right? Like, they just got to show they can do the same stuff. And based on QuantumScape's data, and the back bends that they're doing to sort of claim that it can. I mean, it appears that it's just so far away, it's not even realistic.
Well, I know that there's stuff beyond just the scientific claims that make this a viable short candidate for you, but let's quickly run through those five claims and how you're able to refute them. So the first claim is that the battery can be charged up to 80% in under 15 minutes. Why is that claim, a fraudulent claim under your opinion?
So there are four red flags here. So the first red flag is that there's a graph that they show, which shows the charge time for their battery. And when we had a leading solid-state researcher analyze that graph, we zoomed into that data. It appears that the data points are fake. They're just made up because when you compare the line that they have right next to it for conventional lithium-ion technology, the distribution of the points is what you would expect in a real data set. And the distribution that you see in the QuantumScape one is it's too perfect. Every little line is like perfectly spaced. So one is the data points to us appear to be fake. Number two, they don't even tell you what the capacity of the cell is. And, our analysis suggests that it's, on the order of a hearing aid battery.
They couldn't even be bothered to use a random number generator to create their fake data.
Exactly. And, this whole notion of data that's too good to be true is what often trips up frauds. So the third red flag here is that they don't tell you that fast charging destroys the battery's life. So, any battery manufacturer will tell you that if you really quickly, charge a battery, you discharge it to like, 100% of its capacity. The more you do that, the more you degrade it. And the company's being very disingenuous, not really telling you that the battery quickly degrades if you charge it to 15 minutes. And the fourth point here is that they misrepresent lithium ion charge times as being like ridiculously slow. So there's kind of really no major advantage here. So those are the four points on, fast charging. The second key point that they make, and this is actually a very important one, is about dendrite resistance. And we haven't talked about this issue, but it's actually
Yeah,
one of the most
could
important
you
issues.
define dendrites and why
Yeah,
dendrites
so
would be useful?
dendrites are these metallic growths that lithium metal is prone to. When you start moving a current through lithium, like little blobs form. They look like moss, like little bubbles. And it's been an unsolvable problem, for more than 100 years. It's just an innate tendency of lithium metal to do that. It plates when you start putting a current through it. QuantumScape claims that they found this magic material. They just kind of stumbled into it that is dendrite resistance, and that's what they're going to use as their separator. That's what they're going to use in the middle of that pool instead of water, and that's what the lithium ions are going to end up moving through, is that ceramic-based separator. I forget the number of ex-employees that we talked to that characterized that claim as being simply untrue and potentially fraudulent. It may have been five or six employees, if I'm remembering correctly. So the amount of skepticism among their former employees about these breakthrough claims was actually astounding. More specifically, the red flags here are, number one, they use a test called the pulse test. That's a very well-known gimmick, and we talk about why it's a gimmick in extensive detail in the report. The second key point here is that they cranked up the temperature during the test to, I believe it was 113 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason that's very important is that one of the ways you can prevent dendrites is by heating lithium metal, right? So as you heat it up, it just becomes more porous, it becomes more pliable. And these little dendrite growths, they just kind of smooth out. Heating it is a way of cheating. And if your material actually has the characteristics that you claim it does as far as dendrite resistance, you shouldn't actually have to resort to much higher temperature than is normal. The other quick red flags here are that they do tell you the size of the lab prototype and their other cells. On this one, they don't tell you. And the reason I think they don't tell you is because it's even tinier than the other coin-sized cells that they're using, because dendrite risk is a function of surface area, right? The bigger you kind of scale the surface area, the more easy it is to get a dendrite. So one way around that, just use like a tiny little sample. And the last point here is that they only show a one-time test, and dendrites happen with repeated charging and discharging. So if you just, charge the battery like once, like who cares, right? What happens after you charge and discharge a bunch of time? What happens to dendrites then? So the test that they show is utterly meaningless. It proves actually nothing as far as dendrite resistance.
Well, and on top of that, you know, you talk about this long history of promotion and fraud in the space. One of the main red flags that has been highlighted throughout the history of the battery industry is this: we've discovered a super material, which, yeah, you know, we have this new material. That was raised as like one of the main red flags. Anytime somebody says, we've developed this new material that has these characteristics, that's just a red flag in general.
Great point. And, you know, we don't even think the material here is like, you know, that particularly new. So we think the material is a ceramic compound called LLZO. There are a number of people that have, you know, analyzed their patent filings. There have been some really interesting Twitter threads by battery experts. You know, we talked to a lot of former employees to kind of get their sense of what some of this public commentary was around, you know, the patents and potential choice of materials. And there are many other solid state efforts that have tried to use LLZO and they didn't work. So, you know, this material that they claim is this magical material, we believe quite strongly that they are using LLZO, and other people that have used it, you know, have found that it's not quite as magical as, you know, as the company claims. So you're right. You know, all this stuff about some novel material, you know, some of these solid state battery companies that we think were frauds, you know, which were backed by the investors in QuantumScape, you know, is the same kinds of claims. You know, we have a new structure for the solid state battery. We kind of have this new sort of material, this kind of cool separator, and, you know, it's all bogus.
Okay. Well, it seems like that claim is also related to the next claim around performance in low temperatures. So, you know, that's obviously hugely important. We don't only sell EVs in California. I think that the largest EV market in the world right now is in Norway. So clearly being able to be active in low temperatures is very important, at least in the current state of the electric vehicle market. You know, how important is that, and how far off from the mark of functionality are they?
So you're absolutely right. Low temperature performance is vital. And some of the most devastating color we received from ex-employees about their data being problematic was actually on this point. Because just to use a little bit of common sense again, right? So, you know, a conventional liquid lithium-based, right, lithium-ion battery compared to a solid battery, the only way you can really get ions to move through a solid separator is you have to make it active, right? You have to excite it. So you use heat, right? Essentially to sort of like, you know, soften it up. So the notion that you would have better performance in low temperature than a liquid material, which is what their chart claims, is preposterous just to begin with. And that was the way that some former employees framed it for us. They were like, look, this just cannot be true. Okay, let's just kind of use some common sense, right? Compare liquid to a solid, right? Like, this just can't be true. But the three specific points I'll make here are, first of all, they claim to show performance in low temperatures. If you look at the fine print for that slide, it actually shows they charge that battery at 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, that does not sound like low temperature performance to me. You know, then they discharge it at a low temperature. So their definition of low temperature performance is, hey, you know, it's going to be Miami type weather that morning, you know, in like Norway, but the rest of the day when it's really cold after you charged it, you know, kind of in your sauna or by sticking a bunch of, you know, heaters in your garage, you know, then it's all cool. So they don't even charge it under low temperature conditions. The second red flag is that, you know, former employees that we talked to, so they've never been able to get this to work, which is not surprising given that nobody else has been able to get it to work. And it appears like this sudden discovery out of the blue, like they couldn't solve it. All of a sudden now there's a SPAC transaction to be had. There's a stock price to maintain. It's like, we solved it. So the sudden, you know, solution to a problem that stumped everybody, the timing of that, you know, we think is just kind of really odd. It's fine if you want to claim low temperature performance. I think, you know, what further erodes your credibility, aside from just kind of violating, you know, basic laws of physics and common sense, is to then take it a step further and say that it's actually better than conventional lithium ion. Like, that's where you just start. Look, this is a problem that a lot of frauds run into. You know, they kind of have a game, they kind of keep it going, then they kind of get Icarus syndrome, right? They fly too close to the sun, they start drinking their own Kool-Aid, and that's kind of stuff that trips them up. You know, the other claims, I think, you know, the flavor of things that we're talking about, I think, are, you know, fairly similar. I think people can look in the deck if they're interested. You know, they claim to have, you know, an automotive power profile. You know, they have a simulation. You know, we showed that data to, like, you know, leading experts in the field, and they're like, this is not decipherable. Okay, we do this all day long. We have no clue what this chart means, what these axes on the chart means, what these little curves mean. They just don't make sense. Okay, so in our experience, when we look at frauds and promotes, that is never an accident. okay, you want to make something clear, it's pretty easy to make it clear. If you want to play games and you want to try like obfuscate, well, you kind of put out slides like the type that these guys have put out. You know, so those are, you know, some of the red flags on the technical claims. I think just some other points that I'll, you know, hit here. Even if the science is real and those technical claims are true, they still got to make this stuff at scale. You know, we spent a lot of time in our deck talking about scalability and manufacturing problems and essentially universal skepticism among former employees of the company. This could ever be made at scale. I mean, they classify this as maybe 1%, 5%, 10% of the problem is getting the science to work. All of it is being able to make this. And I think their public comments actually Elon Musk has made out there, which are similar. You know, look at these semiconductor fabs that are out there. I mean, it's just the manufacturing side is very, very complex. And on the non-technical side, just some things that we want to caution investors about. You know, there's a lockup that expires if there's certain conditions that are met around the stock price, which appear like they're going to be met. You know, the stock has to be north of $12, I think, you know, for a certain period of time. And that's coming up, right? That's right around the corner.
That's when insiders can sell?
That is our understanding, based on what we've read in the filings, yes, that insiders will be free to sell starting on April 24th.
And this isn't the first lockup that has come up. There was another one earlier, really at the beginning of 2021, there was another lockup that came up for the PIPE investors because this is a SPAC.
Right, great point. So let me explain that a little bit because it technically wasn't a lockup, but very similar lockup, but very important to understand because we think that is a preview of what could happen when the actual lockup expires. So in conjunction with their SPAC transaction, they issued 50 million shares to what they call certain subscribers, and they call them the PIPE shares. So 50 million shares at $10 a share, so 500 million. So the company's filing state that they were obligated to file a registration statement for resale to enable those subscribers to essentially flip those shares. So they bought them in late November. And, you know, the stock dropped 40, 50% over the span of like two trading sessions at the end of December and the end of January. And people were like, what happened? Okay, they couldn't figure it out. Like you kind of go look at Forbes, look at Barron's, you could kind of, you know, all these like, you know, stock commentary sources online, people were completely confused. In our view, it is patently obvious what happened. The day before 4 p.m., at QuantumScape's request, the SEC made effective their ability to, they made a registration statement effective so they could actually go ahead and flip those shares. So that became effective at 4 p.m., and we think that, you know, people just kind of ran for the exits at the very next opportunity. The stock was, I think, at like 80 or 90 then.
Why not?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, people's wildest dreams, they thought this thing would ever get there. So I think they were like, you know, we don't care if we crush this thing like 80%. We just want to get the hell out. I suspect that's going to be the mentality of insiders kind of after the after lockup expires. So it's a huge risk factor that I think people need to be aware of.
Yeah, those shares, it looks like, I mean, you said 50 million at $10 a share. A month later, it was trading at $80 or $90 a share. So that's an eight bagger in a month. Yeah. And then the volume the next day was 85 million shares. So yeah, they, technically, it could have been all 50 million of those special shares could have been dumped in that one.
I mean, look, if you were one of those PIPE subscribers and you didn't flip 100% of your shares that day, you're an idiot.
So on top of that, there's other stuff. Like, I want to talk about Volkswagen because that has been sort of the, it's been part of the hype, but it's also been part of the, you know, Volkswagen is a smart company. They've been around for almost 100 years, and that's part of the, the truth behind it. People cite Volkswagen as the reason why you should trust QS, but it seems like Volkswagen doesn't really trust QS. What is the relationship between Volkswagen and what are some of the doubts that even their partners have with their ability to deliver on their promises?
So thanks for bringing that up. I actually forgot about it. You know, there's so much material in the deck that it's kind of, you know, hard to keep track, even, you know, having written it. But, you know, the Volkswagen angle here is absolutely fundamental because QuantumScape is a very secretive company. You know, for years and years, they said nothing. All of a sudden, there's an opportunity to kind of do a SPAC last year. And boom, out of the blue, after like, you know, kind of being mute for a decade, right? They released some scraps of data. They got a lot of criticism, you know, from experts in the field that basically called bullshit. You know, it's too good to be true. It can't be real. And so the strategy that the companies use is to basically lean on Volkswagen and just say, well, you know, Volkswagen's our biggest investor, right? It's a major automotive OEM. And there are statements from the CEO that we document in our deck I mean, he really promotes the VW validation as a key part of the story. And we spoke to two current employees of Volkswagen. They're involved in their EV battery effort. They outlined for us their interactions with QuantumScape. And I want to be clear that we do not ask for, nor were we given, any lab results, any data, any confidential information, of QuantumScape that Volkswagen is in possession of. We just asked them for their opinion. We asked them to comment on some of these, articles that are out there. It appears in those articles that Volkswagen is blessing the technology, and they essentially call total bullshit on it, right? So I think some of the high points are, they said, well, we've seen almost nothing. Okay, they said it's a black box. We don't even know the chemistry or the materials, any particular detail here. Everything that we're getting is, highly massaged. It's like nice PowerPoints, which is a very different narrative than, what the company has been painting. It's an open kimono. They've seen everything, right? So you got to believe what they say. So they're like, well, we really don't know. So much so that they actually describe tension in their relationship, right? One of the people said that QuantumScape is actually blocking us from time to time, right? They describe them as not being cooperative. They said it's not even a real R&D relationship. So there are extensive comments in our deck from these people at VW, and I think they're devastating for anybody that's in the stock based on what they think VW thinks about QuantumScape. But I think the second part of it, aside from the skepticism and aside from their saying they actually haven't seen much in the way of data, is that they actually said they don't have faith in a lot of the technical claims, right? They said, look, we understand how EV batteries works, right? We've worked with these technologies. We know it's really easy to show stuff in like these coin-sized cells, right? So, the other odd dynamic here to understand is, right, somebody might say, well, didn't Volkswagen just invest a bunch more capital in QuantumScape the other week? Like, why are they investing all this money? And you have to recognize, the way these big companies work, right? There's a lot of politics and corporate bureaucracies. Volkswagen had this whole scandal with Dieselgate. People went to jail.
Marketing you can write off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They want to play in the hype, right? They want to get out there. They want to compete with the PR that Elon Musk has. On April Fool's Day, Volkswagen, announced that they're changing the name to Volkswagen. Okay, which they thought was funny. A lot of battery journalists that fell for and just kind of general journalists, you kind of go look at these Twitter threads. People were pissed off, right? But that's kind of how hungry they are to just sort of participate in a lot of this, EV hype. But within the ranks at Volkswagen, there's an entirely different perspective towards QuantumScape based on the two conversations that we had with people that we think have a pretty good sense of what the mood is. And so they doubt it. The engineers doubt it.
On top of the doubting, they also say that the positioning of QuantumScape relative to their peers is also, assuming that they're correct, even assuming they're telling the truth, it doesn't put them above their peers as potential partners. That the idea that they're going to choose QuantumScape, even if some of this stuff is true, is still not even clear.
I thought their level of ambivalence, how non-committal they were about QuantumScape, I thought was very interesting relative to some of these other early stage players. And that, I think, leads to another key point, which is around, the timing of when VW could actually scale purchase and orders, because there are financial projections that QuantumScape has in their deck, that show them getting to billions of dollars in revenue in 5 or 7 years, these Google-like EBITDA margins. And the bulk of that revenue, obviously we think has to come from QuantumScape, right? That's kind of their main backer. And VW said, look, nothing's happening for a decade. Right. Even if the science checks out, we might get to a show car kind of near the end of the decade. Then we have these 5-year planning cycles. Right. One of the guys said, I can tell you every supplier, every battery, every component that's going to be in all our cars for the next 5 years. It's like the Soviet Union. Right. These automakers that kind of work on these 5-year planning cycles. If the science isn't there yet, you're 5 years away once the science is there, which is probably a decade away. So it's like a 2030 to 2040 kind of a story, even if everything else is true. And that came out loud and clear. From those same VW conversations that, we're not only ambivalent about the science, we don't know what it is, but maybe we'll work with them, maybe we won't. There are a bunch of interesting people out there. We're not even sure the technology works. It was actually, not the kind of tone that you expect from a company that is a key part of why this thing is a $20 billion market cap.
So there's one more key point that I want to touch on before we get to really summarizing all these points, because there are a lot of points, and so I want to tie it all together at the end. But it's the CEO, the face of the company, and how he operates and what his employees, his former employees, had to say about the environment within the company. I think it's very characteristic of, you described it as being like Theranos, in a way, the way that there's this cult of personality around the CEO. So can you talk to me a little about who he is and what the dynamic is for the employees within the company?
You know, that's very interesting. And, you know, just in full disclosure here, so, you know, his previous IPO was a company called Infinera. I was stupid enough to go long that stock. And I think it was, sometime kind of, the spring of 2009. And I very vividly remember having a conversation with the CEO. And I would characterize that conversation as being highly promotional. Like, I was shocked at how promotional it was, but whatever. And I held on to the stock. And then very quickly thereafter, I think it may have been just a few weeks after I had this, IR-sponsored call with him, he announced that he was leaving. And I felt like I had just been played for a fool. And, you know, the more time you spend in the markets, the more cycles you go through, you know, the smarter and the wiser that you get. So that was a window for me into his MO. And as I started following QuantumScape and we started doing these research calls with former employees, one of the things we always ask about is the culture of the company, you know, the ethics of the management team, any bad behavior that they witnessed. And there are a lot of things that we heard that we would characterize very Theranos-esque. I think one of the really striking ones, which we often see in frauds and promotes, although I think this may be the most intense version I've ever seen, is a tremendous amount of fear on the part of ex-employees. And the other people that we've talked to, they've talked to former employees that had a similar opinion of the mood that we did, that people just seem very frightened. And this is just not talking about anything which is confidential, just talking about their opinions of the company. There was a lot of fear. And the color suggested practices that we think, we've seen those, and, they're biotech companies that we shorted, biotech companies. It's kind of like a biotech, right? It's like an early stage biotech. You put out data, put out phase one, phase two results. There are all kinds of tricks and gimmicks that you can use. You know, we've shorted things where like the data was completely made up. It was like an outright fraud. And there are things that you observe, right? Like, but one thing I'll point out with, QuantumScape is like, if you kind of look at early in one of their decks, I think this may have been their, December 8th battery showcase. In really big font at the beginning, they say, 200 patents. Okay. Something along those lines, 200 patents. There's a little asterisk. Okay. You go at the bottom, it's like, 6-point font, it says, oh, it's like, patents and filed patents. Now, I didn't go back and look at how many of those 200 patents are actually filed patents, but patents. But the flavor that you kind of get from their deck is anytime there's an opportunity, to kind of like cheat and bullshit people and mislead people, they seem to kind of take it, right? And that plays out in spades on the slides where they actually kind of talk about the data. But even little things, right? Like, why don't you just say, 200, patents, like approved and pending, instead of calling applications like patents. That philosophy came out loud and clear from the ex-employees that we spoke to. And, there are quotes from those ex-employees that we have at the beginning of the deck. People can read them. They can make up their own mind as far as what the implication of those quotes is. The implication that we took away is that, there's high risk of things happening here that have tripped up a lot of companies and ended up being high profile frauds and blowups.
Yeah, there was one that I saw that really stuck out to me that was like, if there's a line, he's on it, or something along those lines. But we've touched on so many things, from the scientific claims to the timing of this report coming out right around the lockup ending for insiders to be able to sell, to just the ambivalence of Volkswagen. Can you summarize what you think are the key points that, investors, whether they're short or whether they're holders of the stock, should be taking away from our interview today?
I think there are two simple points. Number one, the science, the claims about the technology, the claims out of the breakthrough, they don't check out. We just don't think they're true. And this is an early stage, very early stage technology company. If the science doesn't check out, there's nothing to hang your hat on. That's point number one. So I don't know what the thesis is. Point number two is that you actually have a catalyst. in the form of the lockup expiring. And the insiders at this company are people that, in our opinion, have, you know, a habit of dumping and getting out quickly. And, you know, this CEO is, you know, he's on CNBC, he's on Yahoo Finance, you know, he's out there, he's pumping the stock. You know, his holders are pumping the stock on Twitter. There's a typical pump and dump scheme here, right? You come up with a bunch of claims that we don't think are true. You try to keep the stock up long enough before insiders can start dumping shares. I mean, it's just a, you know, there's no other way I can kind of characterize sort of a classic pump and dump. And, you know, pump and dumps tend to make great shorts and not very good longs.
So QuantumScape, they have the lockup expiring on April 24th. Obviously, it has been a tumultuous environment for short sellers over the past few months with GameStop and other notable short squeezes. How are you thinking about risk management? How are you thinking about the best way to play a short like this?
The two most important things for any short, you know, assuming you have the thesis right, are sizing and timing. It's all about risk management. So, you know, I'm not in the business of providing investment advice. I'm just sharing my opinions on a particular idea. I think people have to ascertain, you know, kind of what their risk capacity is in their portfolio, what percentage of their portfolio they want to allocate to a particular short, you know, how long they want to hold it for. You know, across the set of criteria different investors might have there as far as they think about a short, we think this checks off a lot of boxes.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Keir. Certainly an interesting idea. And the report, I got a chance to look at the rough draft. I'm excited to see it come out. I think it's coming out next week. And it is incredibly robust with details on each of those scientific claims, the quotes from employees, quotes from Volkswagen, as well as some of their own material that you think is pretty damning as well. So I recommend that everybody go take a look at that.
Thanks so much, Max. Really appreciate it.